Native American Arts Association versus Waldron. Mr. Mullen.
Please the court, your honors. And I am Michael Patrick Mullen on behalf of Native American Arts and the Ho-Chunk Nation, an Indian tribe acting as a representative plaintiff. On behalf of Native American Arts.
Mr. Mullen, before you start out, I do have sort of one question that I'd like to get out of the way, please. And that is whether Judge Duryigian's holding that the instruction is unconstitutional, whether that had an impact on the case in any other way, in any way other than his refusal to instruct the jury on the regulation?
It did, Judge, in terms of it wasn't available for argument either, Judge. And of course, we feel that the main thrust of this statute is represented by that regulation, which, of course, was an express delegation by Congress to the Secretary of the Interior and then adopted after appropriate notice and rulemaking procedures. So it is, indeed, as much part of the statute that had Congress.
I don't know what the regulation means, actually, the word unqualified. I mean, suppose you had some, so this is crafts and things, applies to, so suppose you had some little model of an Apache helicopter, right? So it's so Apache. Here's an Apache helicopter. Is that a violation of the regulation?
I don't believe so, Judge. I don't think this statute and the regulation talks about it regulates the use of those terms in connection with the origin of a product that's an art and craft product. So it's a very limited area. It's not.
Well, you can certainly have a craft, an art and craft. I don't know what art and craft means, but you have a model, you know, maybe it's fancy, and it's labeled Apache helicopter.
Yeah.
So there's an unqualified, I don't know, maybe that's qualified, maybe we're a helicopter qualified. I just wonder whether you think the regulation applies to that term.
I don't think so, Judge. I don't think that
And why not? How do we interpret the regulation so that that's not covered? This is actually like the last case. You know.
Because the Apache helicopter is not an art or craft item, and the
I don't understand you. You could have anything can be an art and craft item, can it?
No, sir. There are certain part of the definitions under regulation is it has to be a traditional or non-traditional Indian
traditional
art or craft product. So it's a certain type
that's in the regulation?
That's in a different part of the regulation, not the regulation at issue 309.24, Judge. I think it was in 309.2, but I could be wrong.
So you're saying there's a definition of art and craft product somewhere in these regulations that would exclude some of these absurd cases?
Yes, Judge. And you draw upon the history of art and craft, Native American
and
arts.
Do you know what that regulation is, or it's just somewhere?
I think, I could be mistaken, Judge, but I think it was 309.2, and it defines an art or craft item as a historical, traditional, or non-traditional Indian art and craft product. And this draws in the history of it. So what we're talking about are arts like dream catchers, mandalas, certain types of jewelry, etc. And the problem in this case is the use of those terms, Indian, when you put the word Zuni or Winnebago or Navajo on an earring product, it's a suggestion that it's Zuni, Navajo, or
well, you
Winnebago
argued that
made.
To the jury in your closing argument, didn't you?
Pardon, sir?
You argued that to the jury in your closing argument, didn't you?
I did, Judge.
Yeah. So what exactly would have been added if you'd had an instruction?
We would have had to force a law. They would
Excuse
have been
me?
Told We would have
No, but when you said to the jury that the use of the word Indian without qualification suggested that that was produced by Indians, you weren't going outside the instructions, were you?
No, I wasn't, Judge. But the point is that we didn't have the benefit of the jury being accurately, clearly, and completely instructed
as to what the law was. Okay, I don't understand. So if you read this not unqualified literally, why didn't you move for summary judgment? I mean, there's no dispute over the fact that they used the word Indian without saying Indian-inspired or something like that. So what would be the jury issue?
Well, the defendant argued that there were other parts of the tags and the marketing materials that actually made the use of the terms Indian, et cetera, as
not. Well, I understand that, but the regulation, why the regulation, if it's applicable and it's you know, interpreted literally, there's no triable issue as to whether they violate the regulation, is there?
Well, perhaps
you don't regard that as, or do you regard that as arguable?
I don't, Judge. I personally don't. But we didn't take that approach, and this is the first case that was tried. There was the first case that Judge Terhigen tried, and it were sort of.
I don't know what that has to do with whether you move for summary judgment or not.
The jury was advised that one violates the statute when she offers a good for sale in a way that falsely suggests that the good was Native American / Indian produced, wasn't it?
That is correct. What happened in the instruction?
What I'm trying to figure out is what would an instruction about the regulation have added to the jury's understanding?
It would have added that the regulation states that if you use those terms in an unqualified manner, it's a representation or statement that it is indeed Indian made. And as Susanna pointed out, that is pretty solid reference to the jury.
But that's not a disputed point, so I don't understand what the jury would do with it. I don't get that.
Well, the jury would apply that in that context, that here's a defendant who is using those.
But what's so confusing is, on the one hand, you say to the jury, if it's unqualified, it's a violation per se. If it's qualified, then it could still be a violation if there's a misleading suggestion. But there's no dispute as to whether it was qualified or unqualified, is there?
Again, the defendants were arguing that the other context and other language in the marketing materials trumped, if you would, the regulation.
What do you mean trumped? Qualified?
Qualified the Indian, the use of those terms. That's why the use
Well, do you disagree with their... So they're saying the qualification can come from outside. It doesn't have to be Indian-inspired. If you look at the name Waldron or if you look at the advertising or something, you'll figure out that it's not Indian. Is that a permissible interpretation of the regulation?
No, I don't believe so, Judge. But that is the defense that was raised. And the use of the regulation...
But did you say to the judge, look... The regulation doesn't mean that.
What we argued to the judge was that the regulation is required because it was mandated by Congress.
Why did you want an instruction on the regulation? Why didn't you want summary judgment?
Well, maybe that was an error not to move for summary judgment.
What do you think the jury was going to do with the regulation?
With the regulation, the jury would have said, here's a representation that it's Indian-made. And view that law, that principle of law given by the judge, in the context of the overall case when the defendants are saying...
What do you mean context of the overall case? According to you, the regulation standing by itself simply demonstrates a violation. There's no need to look at anything else.
But that's
Isn't that your view?
That's my view, Judge, but there is no established law to that effect.
What do you mean
right
no established law? What do you mean no established law? The regulation says unqualified violation. What do you need established law for?
Well, because the defendants are arguing that you look at it in the context of the overall thing. And the point is, Judge, that if the jury, and there were other problems with the instructions as well, if the jury doesn't know that the law requires that unqualified use is a representation and it's intermediate, then they can't handle the case in the context of all the evidence.
Forgive me. Is it because you think that the jury might have thought you're only liable under the statute if you use a term like genuine Native American craft or made by an Indian or made by a Native American?
Exactly, Judge, and that's what the defendants were arguing to this jury. And the jury was completely unguided on that point. Had they been given a law, this law, regulation, they would have been able to handle that type of an argument. And that's exactly what the defendants were arguing, that there had to be some kind of an express statement.
I think the jury would have been extraordinarily confused because they would have been told that if this is unqualified, then it's a per se violation, but otherwise they have to decide whether there's a misleading suggestion. But there's no argument that it was qualified.
Well, there was an argument that it was qualified, Judge. The defense are arguing that the context in which it was used, all the other evidence that they asserted, did, in fact, qualify the use of these terms, Indian, Native American, and particularly the name of the tribe. And therein is the crux of the problem. I mean, they can make that assertion to the jury, but if the jury is not guided by the actual law that applies here, this regulation, then the jury is unclear, they're going to be confused, and they're not going to be guided as to applying the law to the facts of this case.
Does the record contain any information on what the sales were of your client?
There was some evidence, I believe.
Well, what was it?
I think there was in terms of... I'm going on an unrefreshed recollection, but as part of the discovery, there was some disclosure as to...
But you don't know the amount.
Sales figures. Pardon?
You don't know the amount.
No, I don't.
Because the jury wasn't told what the amount of your sales were?
I really don't know the answer to that question.
Okay.
But the problem was that without this instruction, They're clueless and they're not guided at all. And I note that the white light is...
Why isn't it guidance to say, you have to do... Was this a misleading... was the average consumer likely to be misled and think this had been manufactured by Indians? Why wouldn't... That was essentially what the judge instructed. Why wouldn't that give the jury enough... To go on.
Because it ignores the delegation by Congress as to what the interpretation should be.
I don't understand that. The jury was instructed in the language of the statute or something close to the language of the statute. How is it, in a case brought under a statute, why would it be reversible error for the jury to be told that it had to make the decision that the statute says is the critical decision? Because that's what this jury was told.
Because Congress, the statute, as it was outlined by the judge, did not get into what is an Indian product or not. That's what this regulation does. And it's part of the definition of an Indian product.
Is there any grant of authority in the statute for the agency to make rules for the conduct of private litigation?
I'm not sure that I understood Your Honor's question.
This is a private lawsuit. The regulation, as it's drafted, describes proceedings before the agency, not in court. Is there anything in the statute that gives the agency the authority to make rules for the conduct of private litigation? The Supreme Court said in Adams Fruit Company against Barrett that that's an absolutely indispensable requirement where a regulation is sought to be applied in private litigation. Your brief didn't point to any grant of authority. I did a quick look in the statute, couldn't find any. This looks like a rule just for here's what we're going to do as an agency. It doesn't look like a substantive rule for the conduct of private litigation.
Well, I have to disagree with Your Honor. It is a substantive rule.
All right. It's then tell me what part of the statute authorizes the agency to create substantive rules for use in private litigation.
The actual delegation by Congress under the Indian Arts and Crafts Act that they shall define the Indian product aspect. And there is no enforcement, Judge.
Can you
in
tell
the
me, can you, by any chance, tell me what part of the statute that is?
It is, Judge, 305D2, where it states that there's a delegation to the agency to come up with what they came up with as 309.24.
Thank you.
I see. It's on here.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Mullen. Ms. Knight?
Could I have just a minute or two in
rebuttal? Yes, sure. We'll give you
time.
Sure. Good morning. Elizabeth Knight on behalf of the Waldron Corporation. With regard to the argument here that there's been an express delegation from Congress, I submit that counsel is incorrect in citing to 305ED2. That provision simply allows the board to promulgate a specific definition of Indian products. The regulation in question here is not definitional.
Wait. I've got problems with this statute. Is it 305 paren D that you're talking about, or 305D paren something else?
Okay. I'm sorry. It's 305 small e is the false suggestion part of the statute.
It's
and then
305
E. E.
Right.
And then under E, it's subparagraph D2 that counsel is referring to.
Yeah, 305E, I thought I had gone through pretty carefully, but I will look at it again. All right.
And it's subparagraph D2 that allows for the definition of Indian product to be promulgated by the board.
Suppose that we conclude that regulation 309.24 is constitutional. Was NAA prejudiced then by Judge Derdikian's refusal to instruct the jury on the regulation?
No, for two reasons. Aside from the delegation issue, which I'm all right, putting that aside. Aside from that, all of the Waldron products that NAA purchased and all of the Waldron products that were produced in discovery and all references to Native Americans, tribes, and Indians in those products were displayed before the jury product by product by product, with plaintiff arguing that the way in which the terms were used was a false suggestion that they were Indian made.
Well, would the jury have appreciated that Waldron might be violating the statute if it was selling goods using tribal names and terms like Indian or Native American without in some way qualifying those terms?
Well, I guess that's exactly what plaintiff did argue to the jury, is that they weren't qualified, and we argued they were. The reference to the terms, and it was repeatedly referred to in the catalogs and the products.
Was the term qualified or unqualified actually used in the closing arguments?
No. What counsel argued over our objection was that we should have used a disclaimer, and that's what he
meant
by
it. They argued for so you're saying they were suggesting, without referring to the regulation, of course, that the mere use of words like Navajo and so on were misleading, so that you needed a disclaimer.
Correct. Although they didn't use the word qualified, they said we should have used a disclaimer.
Right.
Furthermore, the evidence in the case, if you go through the whole trial record, as the jury did, shows that there were qualified uses of these terms. How can you ever talk about the proscription of the use of English terms, Indian, Native American, and tribe, without talking about the context in which the words were used? The regulation doesn't say anything about context or content or form. Our First Amendment, every time we look at speech, says to at least look to those. But assuming that that such a proscription on the use of the terms in and of themselves, which do not, by the way, suggest origin. If you look at the proscription in the reg of Indian, tribe, and Native American, there's nothing about those words standing alone that suggests the origin of goods. You must put it in context, and that's what we did in the trial court. That's what the jury examined. The terms were used in the third person.
Yeah. Why are you so adamant about the unconstitutionality of the regulation if all it does is state the obvious, which is that if the context doesn't indicate otherwise, then you think the product was made by Indians, right?
Why am I adamant about it? Because yes. It's a clear content-based restraint of speech.
But according to you, I mean, as I understand what you're saying, the regulation is really just another way of stating the statute.
Oh, I don't think so at all. I think it way expands the statute, which is why Judge Terhagen said under Central Hudson, assuming commercial speech here, this can't fly.
But suppose you have, on the one hand, you have someone who says, this is a Navajo bracelet. And then another person says, this is a Navajo bracelet designed by Jerry O'Flanagan, right?
Right.
So the second one, you know, obviously qualifies. Wouldn't you argue? So it qualifies the Navajo bracelet and eliminates the... Isn't that all the regulation is saying, right?
Well, when you have this undefined, unqualified term, from a First Amendment standpoint, it seems that this thing is chilling speech left and right until that term's defined. But if we agree that putting your name on the product like Tricia Waldron did or O'Flanagan did is a qualified use, then it's not narrowly tailored is what the problem with it is.
Reasonably understood, wouldn't it be that the regulation requires some type of disclaimer to alert the consumer that the product wasn't made by a Native American?
Could a requirement of a disclaimer be a qualified use? I think it could be, but the statute doesn't say that. And if this regulation was entitled to require all non-Native Americans who are producing arts and crafts to disclaim the fact that they are not Native American on the face of their product, it sure doesn't say that.
Well, but, you know, conversely, I mean, the literature about her product seems to be rife with tribal names and other terms suggesting that her jewelry is Native American, and nowhere, you know, is there any type of qualifier or disclaimer that would have dispelled that suggestion.
It's correct that we did not use a disclaimer prior to getting sued in this case, but there are qualifiers, Your Honor, and I would ask you to carefully look at the products that are in evidence in this case. Her name appears, Tricia Waldron, in a very prominent place on every single piece of jewelry that was sold and on every catalog. But in examining the evidence, Your Honor, in the trial court, the catalogs and the jewelry reference tribes in the third person. Nowhere in the record, and I'm sure that the jury got so sick of listening to what's
Henry
a noun and what's an
adjective.
Could only be from one or two. I mean, how many tribes could she have been from?
Well, that's the other thing. Her jewelry had...
I don't understand the name business. Henry Ford's name is on every Ford car, but nobody thinks he made them.
Well, if you look carefully...
It could be made by Indians.
If you look at Defendant's Exhibit 11, which is in the record, that's the point of purchase card. There's a picture of Tricia Waldron and referencing her products as her designs, as she's the artist. Tricia Waldron's designs for a different world were all over the product in this case. There was no question about who designed the property.
Well, no, I think you're going too far. All you care about is to say this was a jury issue. A jury could have decided the other way. What you're saying, if I understand your argument, is that there was sufficient qualification, if you want to call it that, sufficient ambiguity to allow a reasonable jury, could find that people wouldn't be misled, not that they had to.
Well, my Rule 50 motion of 57 pages said otherwise, but that's right. Not all here before right. The court. No, certainly to the extent that the word suggest in this statute parallels the Lanham Act, which many district court judges below us have said, This record also is devoid of any confusion in the record, any confusion as to the origin of the goods, as would be required under the Lanham Act. And I know this court, in more than one occasion, on the issue of the likelihood of confusion under the Lanham Act, has suggested when a person puts their name on there, the way Tricia Waldron did, that dispels confusion. I think there's a Chicago Tribune case, Pac-Man Chicago Tribune, that I think perhaps Your Honor authored. In any event, where you put your name on it, that dispels the confusion. So this record, if the Lanham Act was his prima facie burden of proof with regard to the word suggests, the record's devoid of that. But the construction of the use of the English language and the way in which Indian terms were referenced in this case, they were referenced in the third person, never in the first person. And where they were used as adjectives, they were used as adjectives in a way in which they did not construe from an English language sense that it was Indian made, that it was an Indian made product. So we're just talking about descriptive, generic terms under trademark law that, by virtue of this regulation, I guess, have become the property right of Native Americans. But in any event, it is a clear content restraint of speech, not a time, place, manner. It's a don't use the word Indian unless you're Indian.
Do you think there would be any problem with a regulation that said, if you put the word beer on your product and it doesn't contain any alcohol, you have to put a prominent notice to that effect?
I think there's a Supreme Court case about this. Do you have to? Okay. I think there can be legislation for the content of that, and that it can pass constitutional muster, and there is there is.
And so what would be the problem with a regulation saying if you put the word Indian on your product and it's not made by Indians, you have to put a prominent notice to that effect? Why is Indian different from alcohol in the construction I just gave you, or beer?
Because when you put the word Indian...
Or peanut butter, or cheese. If you make your cheese from something other than certain kinds of milk, you have to, under Food and Drug Regulation, put
right.
a notice to
right.
that effect.
And I think they even use the word qualified use in those settings, Your Honor. But when you use the word peanut butter, beer, and cheese, you're referring to what's in the product itself. When you say the word Indian, that's not referring to its origin or who made it.
Yeah. As I'm sure you know, there is elaborate federal regulation about what you say about where a product was made. If your product is made in China, for example, it is legally obligatory to put down made in China.
Right.
No First Amendment problem, I assume, that you see. Or you could say made not in China or made not by Indians or any of the above. I just can't see even a colorable thing having to do with the First Amendment here.
Because it's a restriction of the use of the word no matter how it's used.
Well, but then you have to answer my questions about beer and alcohol in China otherwise. Because you would say, I'm a manufacturer, I can't be forced to use the word China on my packaging okay. if I don't want to.
So a similar regulation saying all non-Native American artists and craftsmen must disclaim that they are not Native American on the face of their products might pass constitutional muster, although I think there are some equal protection problems with that that I raised below, which aren't relevant here in light of the verdict in our favor. In any event, to answer your question, Your Honor, earlier, the whole issue of how the product was used and how the words were used was fully litigated below, was argued below, and so the failure to get the instruction that they wanted would not have changed the result in this case, and certainly shouldn't change, if this court determines it's constitutional, the outcome that took place here.
A couple of minor questions. Is there anything in the record about the plaintiff's sales?
No. There's no competitive injury. There's no Article 3 standing.
I'm just curious, the scale of the operation. You suggest very small with these carts. Apparently they had a retail store for a little while. I just wondered whether there was anything on their aggregate sales.
No, not one iota of proof of what their profits and losses ever were. It was refused in discovery and never introduced in the trial court. And similarly, there was no evidence that...
And my other question is whether you know what regulation defines art and Indian art and craft.
Your Honor, I don't believe there is such a regulation, but I do believe that 305B of the statute itself That answered Judge Easterbrook's question.
Yes,
I'm sorry.
Judge Posner's question is related to mine. I've now gone back and reread and tried to reconstruct my question. It looks like the thing in this regulation, the kind of thing this regulation is doing, is different from the definitional authority to define Indian products given by the statute.
Yes.
Now, maybe your adversary will have some other grant, but I couldn't see anything in the statute that looked like it was a grant for this kind of regulation. But as I say, I'm hardly a specialist. I may easily be missing things here.
There is nothing, Your Honor, to answer that question. And this business about the fact that they allowed for the definition of Indian product to be promulgated by the board in 305ED2 is not a congressional grant to write a regulation that says the board will interpret your conduct if you use the word Indian as being misleading and violative of the statute. There was no express grant of any congressional authority to write that provision. And Judge Shader in the lower courts, where he said that there was, referencing the definition of Indian product, is just mistaken. The Indian product is defined in 305D. And I'm sorry, Your Honor, the definition of art and craft that you asked about earlier, the definition I think counsel was referring to is in the CFR 25 CFR 309.2, and that's where the definition of Indian product is had. And Indian product is where they reference this Indian style, non-traditional Indian style, but I don't remember anywhere
so
ever
your,
seeing
your
a definition.
So your view might be that the statute authorizes 309.2, but 309.24 is, well, still in search of a grant. Okay.
Right. And so under Chevron, there is no legislative grant of authority. And as we argued in our brief, it's interpretive. It says so right on the face of it. How will the board interpret this act?
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Knight.
Thank you.
Mr. Mullen, how much time is he? Well, you didn't have any time, but we'll give you a couple of minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Again, the lack of the use of that regulation left the jury unguided, if you would. And I have to differ with any suggestion that it's not part of the definition of Indian product as delegated by Congress. The regulation 309.24 there talks about the unqualified use of those terms as a representation that it's Indian made and is an Indian product. So that is a further definition of Indian product beyond 309.2. Counsel says that this is a content-based problem, speech. It's not. It's clearly misleading speech.
Let me tell you what my problem with your case. Try to state it clearly, and you tell me what's wrong. Okay. So you could have said to the judge, unqualified means no disclaimer. There's no disclaimer, therefore per se violation, no need for a jury trial or any trial, just summary judgment. You could have said that. You didn't say that. You treated the regulation as, you know, creating some arguable issue for the jury to consider. And my question is, if the regulation is interpreted that way, if unqualified is a broad term and it doesn't necessarily mean no disclaimer, it just means no qualification anywhere, then is there any real difference between that and the statutory language of misleading suggestion or false suggestion? That is, unqualified in the sense that nothing anywhere in the advertising or anywhere disambiguates the use of the Indian term, is that any different? If that's the right interpretation of the regulation, or the interpretation you accepted, is it any different from the statute? So you could argue to the jury, you could make the same argument to the jury with or without the regulation.
Well, it is different from the statute, Judge, because it gets more specific and it shows...
How so?
Because it's the unqualified use of those particular terms rather than just a blanket statement.
Are you saying the regulation requires a disclaimer?
I'm saying a disclaimer would be
yes, but how much
a very good
without
thing,
would be very good, but without a disclaimer, is there any way to qualify?
Yes, they could say false, fake, faux, not genuine.
Well, they're not
imitation, etc., etc.,
etc. Very attractive.
There's all kinds of language that they could use, and I think it's important that the marketplace decide.
Now, what about the example I gave? Suppose it said Indian Navajo bracelet by Kevin O'Reilly.
And the question
is that a qualification?
It could be argued as such, and I think it would be a question of fact.
Okay, well, if that's arguable, that's a clear case, but then why can't they argue? The jury may not believe them. Why can't they argue that Patricia Waldron, that's not as ethnic as Kevin O'Reilly, but nevertheless, you know, maybe that's enough. Is that arguable? Isn't that arguable?
Arguable. That's sort of what they argued in the case. Well, but without the guidance from this regulation, that kind of an argument has more force, and you're eliminating a large part of the statute. Just the words falsely suggestive are not clear enough to the average jury. You have to have some
Think unqualified use is the kind of term that a jury would be comfortable with?
Without some kind of guidance?
Yes.
I think that a jury is better served by having some kind of guidance.
Why wouldn't false suggestion be more?
But it could be by way of argument. It doesn't
have to
be.
Don't you think false suggestion is more intuitive than unqualified use?
Well,
you could say to them, look, people looking at this would say this was made by Indians, not by, you know, a white person. So you argued that. So what practical good would it have done you if in addition to saying that, you'd say they failed to qualify the term?
Because it's not just unqualified use, it's the use of these terms, Indian, Native American, a reference to the tribes, etc. This jury was never told that the use of those terms can create a false suggestion. They were never told that if you use those terms in this context of origin, that indeed you are saying that it's made by a Native American and it's an
but
Indian product.
But you were allowed to argue to them, weren't you, that if you use a term like Navajo bracelet and you don't take and you don't say something to make it clear that it's not made by Indians, people will think it's made by Indians. You certainly argued that, didn't you?
I did argue that. But,
yeah.
But an attorney's argument is disregarded many times. It doesn't have the force of law. It isn't even fact, even. So what the jury needs in order to apply the law to the case is an instruction from the court as to what the law is. And this regulation is the heart of a definition of an Indian product. It's the heart of the statute. The jury never had the heart of the statute before, mm-hmm. and we're not even told that use of these terms, Indian, etc., is improper in the context.
Okay, just one more question. How long did the trial last?
The trial lasted about 6 days.
Eight days? I think it was eight.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Mr. Mullen.
Very good. The last thing I wanted to say, Judge, was that the law of the case is an important issue here, too. The law of the case is important. I think it was clearly violated. And this court could decide and remand this case based on the law of the case here without having to definitively decide all of the constitutional issues on the regulation, et cetera. That's not what we would prefer. Obviously, we would prefer a clear upholding of the constitutionality of the regulation.
I'm not sure how you think we could do that when your best argument may vary.
I believe that this court could do that because there was a violation of the law of the case doctrine.
Are you aware that we have said repeatedly that the law of the case has no effect in the Court of Appeals? The argument you're making is that if District Judge Number 1 got it wrong, and district judge number two then got it right, on appeal we should reverse on the ground that that's a violation of the law of the case and remand with instructions to do it wrong. That's your argument. It's an argument we have considered and rejected more times than I can count, and you appear to be totally unfamiliar with our jurisprudence about this.
I stand corrected, then, Judge.
Okay, well, thank you very much to both counsel.